homage to all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Thereupon the Lord, in order to gladden the four assemblies of the Sangha, and to further lighten up this perfection of wisdom, taught at that time the following verses. Call forth as much as you can of love, of reverence, and of faith. Remove the obstructing defilements and clear away all your taints. Listen to the perfect wisdom of the gentle Buddhas, taught for the good of the world, for heroic spirits intended. All of the rivers in this rose apple island, which cause the flowers to grow, the fruits, the herbs and trees, they all derive their power from the king of the Nagas, from the dragon residing in Lake Anopatapta, from his magical power. Just so, whatever teachings the Jinnah's disciples establish, whatever they teach, whatever they skillfully explain, regarding the work of the holy that leads to the fullness of bliss, as well as the fruit of such work, all that is the Tathagata's doing. For whatever the Jinnah has taught, the guide to the Dharma, his disciples, if genuine, have well been trained in it. From direct experience derived from their training, they teach it. Their teaching stems from the power of the Buddhas and not from their own power. No wisdom can we get hold of. No highest perfection. No bodhisattva. No bodhicitta either. When told of this, if not bewildered and in no way anxious, a bodhisattva courses in the happy one's wisdom. So these are the first five verses of the Prajnaparamita Ratnaguna Sanchayagata, the verses of the perfection of wisdom, which are a storehouse of precious qualities. And these first two chapters of this work are probably the earliest of all of the perfection of wisdom literature, which is a truly staggeringly vast literature. You probably know it as Mahayana literature, literature of the great way of leading all beings to Buddhahood. But it's been pointed out that a number of the verses in this Ratnaguna Sanchayagata are very similar to some of the oldest passages of the Pali Canon found in the Sutta Nipata. And in a way, I think the texts like the Sutta Nipata, the older portions of that, the Ratnaguna Sanchayagata and a few other texts, they form a sort of canon of core Buddhist texts that Bhante has studied and has introduced to the movement over the years. There's all those different seminars that he did, and that, you know, some of the texts he's done more than once. And they're kind of part of the spiritual heritage of our movement. I was talking to Arya Bandhu the other day, and he said, you know, the movement's gone through so many developments over the years, and if you come to it, you know, in recent times, you might not be aware of some of these really quite major sort of spiritual movements that have happened within our history. And a lot of these have actually centre around texts and teachings that Sangharakshita has transmitted to us. Anyway, sometime in August 1976, during the first ever retreat held here at Padmaloka, Bhante led a celebrated seminar on these first two chapters of the Ratnaguna Sanchayagata, and you can see an edit of all that in Wisdom Beyond Words. And there he was, opening up to us. I wasn't on the seminar, but, you know, just being around in the movement, you soon heard about it. It was that sort of thrilling. But all those years ago, to us youngsters, you know, very inexperienced in the spiritual life, I haven't got much more experience now, but anyway, we're even less experienced then. There he was, opening up nothing less than the perfection of wisdom to us. And whilst preserving a sense of its profundity, he made it accessible to us. And I'll try to show you how he did that a bit later. And it's still, I think, an incredibly important you know, teaching that he sort of transmitted at that time that really does need a lot of pondering, a lot of reflecting on, a lot of meditating on, a lot of experience, you know, following up with experience. But before that, I want to make a few general observations as to why I want to speak about this text on the perfection of wisdom. I want to do so because the perfection of wisdom literature is really all about the Bodhisattva. It's all about what we might call the Bodhisattva ideal. It's really just about that. It's all about the Bodhisattva's vision of life, the Bodhisattva's attitude, how he practices, how he lives. But the perfection of wisdom literature does this in a very particular way. It looks at the Bodhisattva's life from the standpoint of the highest perfection, vara paramita, the highest paramita, namely the perfection of wisdom. So the Prajna Paramita literature, the perfection of wisdom literature, describes the Bodhisattva's life from the highest, or if you prefer, the deepest, the most profound perspective of all, an entirely, as it were, transcendental perspective. You're probably all familiar with the six paramitas, the six great Bodhisattva practices: generosity, ethics, patience, effort, meditation and wisdom. In actual fact, generosity, ethics, patience, effort and meditation are not really perfections until they're practiced with wisdom, until they're practiced with prajna. Before that, they're described as mundane virtues. They're very important to practice. You don't leave them, you practice them as fully as you can. You practice them as fully as possible. But they'll only lead to full liberation, to emancipation, when they're conjoined with wisdom, when they are the expression of wisdom, when they're led by wisdom. So we'll be attempting a little look at the Bodhisattva's wisdom tonight, which won't be easy at all. You notice from what I've read so far, I've only read one of the verses that describes the Bodhisattva's wisdom from the Ratnaguna Sanchargata. No wisdom can we get hold of, no highest perfection, no bodhisattva, no bodhicitta either. When told of this, if not bewildered and in no way anxious, a bodhisattva courses in the happy one's wisdom. There are many, many more verses like this throughout this text, and that's just the Ratnaguna Sanchargata. But that verse will be quite enough for us this evening, for a lifetime. It's just a homeopathic dose that we need of the verses to do with perfection of wisdom. All the verses before that verse are really describing the preparation, the necessary, the crucial preparation if we're going to be able to hear, to listen to take in the perfection of wisdom, to take it in properly and fully. Because the perfection of wisdom is notorious for being misunderstood. In fact, throughout this text, there are dire warnings of what can happen if you misunderstand the perfection of wisdom. If you, you know, they say things like that, if you don't hear it, if you don't read it and take it in the right way, you're just an unglazed pot that is destroyed by moisture. So, yes, if you hear the perfection of wisdom and you're not ready for it, it can destroy you, it can destroy your spiritual life. Perhaps especially in the modern world, perhaps especially in the modern West, where, you know, because, you know, we put such a sort of emphasis on our intellectual knowing. We can even think that we know what it means to go beyond knowing. We know what it means to go beyond words, but that remains purely intellectual, and we just tie ourselves in knots. So the traditional preparation is absolutely crucial to receive the teachings of the perfection of wisdom. We also have to remember that the perfection of wisdom is the Buddha's wisdom. It's the advanced Bodhisattva's wisdom. Beings who are filled with love and compassion for others, who work tirelessly to enable others to flourish, to grow in the direction of enlightenment. That is how their perfection of wisdom expresses itself. You know, if you want to know what the perfection of wisdom looks like, look, if you can find one, at a living bodhisattva. Look at the life of the Buddha. The perfection of wisdom expresses itself in activity, as Bhante says gnomically in one of his early essays. Compassion is the activity of emptiness. It doesn't express itself through being clever with Buddhist concepts. So the text begins with paying homage to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And we're told that the Buddha wanted to gladden the entire Sangha. Wanted them, when you look at the Sanskrit, the word for gladden is actually extremely joyful. He wanted them to be extremely joyful through hearing a teaching that made the perfection of wisdom light up. The Sanskrit word for light up can even mean flare up, fire up in them. Sangharakshita, Bhante says, in other words, the Buddha wanted to give his Sangha, his disciples, a special treat, as it were. And this is in itself significant. You know, we might think of the Buddha as, you know, a great teacher, giving clear, detailed, very progressive analyses of the path, you know, maybe with lots of lists and quite complicated discussions. And sometimes when you look at some of the teachings in the Buddhist texts, it can appear a bit like that. But really, when the Buddha taught, and you can tell this from people's response when they hear it, if they hear it well, he is giving, he's communicating from the wealth of the Dharma that is within him, that is around him. The Buddha isn't interested in giving a worthy, edifying sermon. He's certainly not interested in giving an academic discourse. Yes, the Buddha's teaching will be clear and spiritually useful, but the Buddha's communication is always spontaneous. He doesn't really need to, in a sense, think about it. It's always uplifting and rousing. It's something actually to enjoy, something to take pleasure in, something that gives pleasure. Even if it's a demanding teaching, a difficult teaching, it's something that it's to be approached more like looking at a work of art or something like that, or to take a more sort of gross analogy. Sometimes the Buddha's communication is likened to the spreading of a great feast that's just laid out before us. There's just the sheer abundance of the Dharma, of the spiritual life laid out for us. And what we have to do is take it in and enjoy it. I think if we approached the Buddhist text in terms of enjoyment, in terms of poetry, we'd get a lot more out of it. And if instead of just trying to sort of nut it out with our heads. And to enjoy the teaching, we need to do something ourselves, of course. We need to call forth from within ourselves certain qualities. So these beautiful, quite famous verses, words. Call forth as much as you can of love, of reverence and of faith. Remove the obstructing defilements and clear away all your taints. Listen to the perfect wisdom of the gentle Buddhas, taught for the good of the world, for heroic spirits intended. So first of all, these words, love, reverence and faith. Now the word for love in Sanskrit here, unusually, is prema. Prema. We're used to thinking of prema as the sort of near enemy of maitri. Pema is the Pali. The near enemy of metta. Attached love, you might call it. But here, it's being used to really describe a very strong devotional love for the Buddha. A very strong devotional love. Yes, maybe you could even think of it as an attached love, a sort of positive attached love. It's as if the Buddha or the early Buddhists are saying, well, you know, if you really want to get attached to somebody, get attached to the Buddha. If you really want to fall in love with somebody, fall in love with the Buddha. Get attached to the Buddha. Get fixated on the Buddha. Have the Buddha in your mind all the time. If you need to have somebody in your mind all the time, that someone who's going to make everything all right, who's going to give you all the wonderful answers to life, all that beauty, all that meaning, all that mystery. That's fine. Have that, but make it the Buddha. Make it the Buddha. That's positive love, positive attachment. Get really focused on the Buddha. You know, you're going to be attached to something. You can't just go straight from attachment to non-attachment. So become attached to the Buddha. You know, it's interesting when you read descriptions of Buddhanusati, Buddhanusmriti, recollection of the Buddha. The way they talk about it is not just a little bit of meditation, you know, where you bring the Buddha to mind, you know, before a puja or something like that. They talk about this sort of practice, that it's continuous. It's day and night practice. The Buddha is always before you, always in your mind. Pingya, in his praises of the way to the beyond, he doesn't just say, well, I do a bit of meditation every day on the Buddha. He said, I spend my nights, all night, revering him. There is no time for me where I am not apart from the Buddha. Wherever he goes, I go. Wherever he goes, my mind goes. In fact, later on it says, this is liberation. So this is what we need to do. The Buddha needs to be there with us all the time. And we need to be feeling real love, real devotion. You know, if you want to imagine or even reimagine the Buddha, you have to have very strong emotional responses, love, devotion, in order to imagine the Buddha, recollect the Buddha. And of course, this can be expressed. When you have such love, you want to beautify, you want to adorn. You know, when you love somebody, you adorn them, don't you, with all beautiful things. So you can offer flowers and lights and perfumes and incense and praise. You can offer all of the most beautiful things. You do that to someone, you know, we do that to somebody we love ordinarily. So we can do it, of course, in relation to the Buddha. Should do it more in relation to the Buddha. And then there's reverence. Reverence. Gaurava is the Sanskrit. Gaurava in Pali. And Gaurava comes from a root meaning weighty, even heavy. But it's a wholly positive term. You revere that which has weight on you, which really impresses you, which has a profundity to it, which has a kind of gravitas to it. So reverence, Gaurava, means you not only love, you regard the Buddha as very, very, very much greater than you, as infinitely greater than you. That enlightenment is in fact very, very far from you. That the Buddha is like a vast and endless ocean. He's so deep, so mysterious. And all you can do, all you want to do, is to bow your head, is to prostrate, is to serve. You feel that that's the most appropriate expression of your connection with the Buddha. You start to feel that, well, actually, I just want to be a disciple of the Buddha. He is the teacher. He is the sutta. So that's Gaurava, revering. It's very interesting. Bhante's been saying recently, rather paradoxically, that the closer you feel to the Buddha, probably the further away you are. The further away you feel yourself to be, in a way, you're probably closer. And then there is faith after this. This isn't shraddha, it's prasada. That's the Sanskrit word. Yes, it does mean faith, but it also means confidence, clarity, lucidity, tranquility, peace. It means all those things. Because it means all these things because you intuitively know, when you have this quality, what life is really for. You've seen the Buddha, you love the Buddha, you revere the Buddha, and you recognize that you want to become the Buddha. It's the only thing worth doing in life, to attain the fullness of wisdom and compassion. Nothing else will really do. You know full well that it will take everything, that it will take your whole life to do this. It will take even lifetimes. But you don't care about that. That's unimportant. You don't care about that at all. You know your direction. You know what is central now. You know, you feel, you sense something in you that wants to become a Buddha. That something is moving in you, it's impelling you, it's motivating you, almost in spite of yourself. Yes, often in spite of yourself. You kind of rather not, but things have got, you know, too serious, too deep. So actually you just feel confident, you feel clear, you feel at peace. Whatever your psychology, whatever your problems, internal or external, do with circumstances, whatever it might be, actually, you feel real confidence, a deep confidence, a deep faith, because you're confident in the Buddha, you're confident in enlightenment. It doesn't really matter what life has dealt you in other respects. That's all irrelevant. You know what really matters. The Buddha is your refuge. So what could go wrong? What could possibly go wrong? So you feel peaceful. You feel confident. You have faith. And of course, this is expressed in the act of going for refuge. So you call forth that love, that prema, that reverence, Gaurava, and that faith, that prasada. And then you just want to clear from your mind all obstructions and defilements and taints. You see them clearly now. Before your encounter with the Buddha, you know, you might have been kidding yourself, but actually you see your selfishness, your meanness, your laziness, your confusion, your bewilderment, your petty-mindedness, your conceit, your insensitivity, your fear, your trips, and so on. And you just had enough. You've just had enough of all that. You're just fed up with it. So you're just determined to just rid yourself of all that crap. All that stuff that just holds you back, which is inessential, which is not really what you're about. You just want to get it out of your mind and out of your behaviour. Out, demons, out, as Edgar Broughton used to say, if you remember that. Cultural reference there. Some of you won't get it. Out, demons out. They've got to go. Of course, what we have here are the first four stages of the puja, haven't we? Love is like worship. It's expressed in worship. Gaurava, reverence, is like salutation. Prasada is going for refuge and clearing away defilements. Is confession of faults. And then you can listen. Then you can hear. Not just with your ear, but with your heart as well, with your being. Then you can be fully attentive to the perfect wisdom of the gentle Buddhas, which is taught for the good of all beings in the world, taught for their benefit, for their real goal. The word here is artha, artha. Their real good fortune. And this wisdom, it said, is taught for heroes. It's taught for those who want to follow the Bodhisattva path, who want to gain enlightenment for all beings. Whatever that takes, whatever that entails. So Bhante really picks up on this phrase, gentle Buddhas, in different ways. Actually, in the original Sanskrit, the word Buddha isn't mentioned. There is just the word which Edward Conza translates as gentle. And that word is saurata. Saurata, which is the Sanskrit for Surata. So Surata, Saurata, is an epithet of the Buddha. And I think, if I remember rightly, Surata told me that when Bhante named him, he was told that Surata, Saurata, means kind, humble, gentle, well-disciplined, and you don't compare yourself with others. Correct? More or less, thank you very much. Which, of course, is a very attractive way of not just describing Surata, but describing the enlightened man, describing the Buddha. Kind, humble, gentle, well-disciplined, and without conceit, without any kind of comparing himself with others. But Bhante also reads this as meaning, this reference to the gentle Buddhas. He believes that the perfection of wisdom in the Ratnaguna Sanchayagata comes in gently and quietly. It comes in sort of subtly. He quotes from the Bible, the still small voice. It doesn't sort of crash in. It's something very subtle. Hence the need for love and for reverence and faith and purification. We need to do all these things ourselves in order to sense that perfection of wisdom. And, you know, I think it's good on this retreat that we're having these mornings of silence, mornings where there's prostrations and meditation, and maybe mornings of just sitting out, maybe in the garden, maybe with some of the Dharma that we're studying, just in our minds a little bit, and but just listening, just opening up, listening. Well, yeah, listening to the perfection of wisdom. It's there. It's all around. It's no place else. So use the time in the mornings to really listen. Actually, the next two verses continues the theme of preparation, but in a bit of a different way. First of all, the Buddha tells of an Indian tradition of the great Naga king, the great dragon king, that lives in a great lake in the Himalayas. And it's because of the magic power of the dragon king that the rains fall and the rivers flow. And because of that rain and because of those rivers, you get the flourishing of the flowers and the trees and the herbs and the fruits throughout the Rose Apple Island, Jambudvipa, the known world of its time. All the abundance of nature actually comes from a Naga living in a lake in the Himalayas. This was the old Indian tradition. In the same way, all the genuine disciples of the Buddha down the ages who communicate the Dharma do so because of the Buddha. To do that, they've had to thoroughly train in the Dharma as taught by the Buddha, and to have made the Dharma a living experience. But they teach because of the Buddha. They communicate because of the Buddha. They communicate because of what is called the Buddhanubhava. The Buddhanubhava. Anubhava is very hard to translate. It can be translated as power, as might, as strength, as influence, as blessing, as grace. You speak of the Anubhava of the king. It's, you know, that sort of blessing power on the realm. So in the same way, the great disciples of the Buddha communicate because of the blessing, the influence of the Buddha. Now, I think the point being made here is that real teachers, real spiritual friends, regard themselves first and foremost as disciples of the Buddha. And they want people to connect with the Buddha and with his Dharma, because they know that the Buddha and his Dharma brings about the flourishing of the individual, the flourishing of spiritual life. They don't want the great genuine teachers. They don't want themselves to be regarded they don't want the focus in a way to be on them. They want it to be on the Buddha. There's a Pali text where the Buddha talks about the wrong motive and the right motive for teaching. The man with the wrong motive thinks, may they gain faith in me. The man with right motive for teaching says, may they gain faith in the Dharma. Or may they gain faith in the Buddha. May they gain faith in enlightenment. Perhaps we need to ponder that a bit, especially those of us involved in one way or another in communicating the Dharma. Sometimes, of course, people want to know who is enlightened, who has insight. They want to find the great master who will guarantee enlightenment. Actually, I think this little section in the Perfection of Wisdom is saying it's much better to find those who are real disciples of the Buddha. Find those who are genuine disciples of the Buddha, who are inspired and moved by the Buddha, who see themselves as simply as a part of the flourishing of the Dharma in the world, the Dharma that flows from the Buddha. And feel yourself to be a part of that flow, of that stream of the Dharma, of that flourishing, of that abundant flourishing that the Dharma brings about, open to the blessing of the Buddha. So these are just four verses on preparation, and I'm looking at my page number. This is page 22, and I've not far to go in my talk, actually, you'd be pleased to hear. But so most of this is really about preparation. And yes, there's a lot in the, in these verses. But having dwelt on them a bit, and we could go into them even more, but we won't, we can now listen to the perfect wisdom of the gentle Buddhas. No wisdom can we get hold of. No highest perfection. No bodhisattva. No bodhicitta either. When told of this, if not bewildered and in no way anxious, a bodhisattva courses in the happy one's wisdom. So after all that build-up, we're being told that there's no wisdom, the highest perfection, to actually get hold of. There's no bodhisattva, nor what makes him the bodhisattva. There's no, apparently, no arising of the bodhicitta, no will to enlightenment, no aspiration to enlightenment. All of those things that we aspire to, wisdom in the fullest, highest, most profound sense, liberating wisdom, that can't be got hold of. We cannot, it seems, give rise to the bodhicitta. We can't become a bodhisattva. But we're also told at the end, if a real bodhisattva hears this and is not confused, bewildered, or troubled, then in actual fact, he is one who courses. The word is charya, as in our dharmachari. Courses or trains or moves or walks in the wisdom of the happy one. The happy one is Sukhata, which is the name of the Buddha. In other words, if he's not bewildered by this, he courses, he moves in the perfection of wisdom. A little bit paradoxical. Now, when I read that business of no wisdom can we get hold of, no highest perfection, no bodhisattva, and so on and so forth, maybe none of you were bothered by it. But don't think, therefore, that you're a bodhisattva. I mean, I read it, and in a way I'm not that bothered about it. But we mustn't think that, therefore, we're bodhisattvas. Actually, probably, there's a stage of the path where it would be, you know, getting bewildered and troubled by this, disturbed by it, would be an achievement. It would be better for us to be bewildered and troubled by it when we hear this, rather than think we understand it. Sometimes I think we need, when we read these things, we need to try and put ourselves into the minds of the Buddhists who first heard this teaching. You know, I imagine very serious, committed people who've been practicing seriously, devotedly for years and years. They're really devoted to the Buddha. You know, fully committed to the path of wisdom and compassion, incredibly active in their individual spiritual life and spreading the Dharma, serving the Dharma. And then they're told, well, actually, there's no wisdom to get hold of. There's no bodhisattva. There's no bodhicitta. There's none of these things. You know, imagine hearing that, and you actually, you've been living according to that, not as an idea, but really living it. And then a teacher who you really admire and trust just says that plainly, clearly. Well, perhaps something would happen. Something would loosen. Something would be swept away. Perhaps the last barriers would be swept away so that you can fully plunge into the stream of bodhisattva activity. You've sort of, perhaps before then, these things were still slightly external to you. But then you hear those words and it just takes it all away. In a way, a kind of self-consciousness, a kind of egotism taken away. And then you're released. You're just flowing, actually living the bodhisattva path. That's kind of how I imagine it. Perhaps there's an equivalent. I mean, perhaps, let's suppose, you know, we all turned up on a Going for Refuge retreat. And let's suppose Bhante was here and we asked him to give a talk. And he stood up and he said, no going for refuge, no three jewels, no ordination, no order member. And he meant it. I mean, I suspect, you know, we'd probably be, you know, having trouble with our bowels if that happened. You know, I suspect we'd be freaking out. No Sangha, no Buddha. I remember there was a little version of this on a Mythic Context retreat years and years ago, and Aloka was here. And, you know, we'd been doing this intensive, you know, meditation on the refuge tree, and, you know, it was quite an intensive retreat. And one day Aloka came in and he got up and he said, just been talking to Bansi on the phone, and he managed to keep a straight face completely. He's just been talking to Bansi on the phone, and he says it's all a mistake. You know, all this is a mistake. And you could feel for a moment that, you know, it wasn't a joke. And I remember one alder member in particular, quite senior alder member, got absolutely furious. Very interesting. Yeah, Arlo could say it's a joke, you know, and all the rest of it. But it was very interesting. Very interesting exercise. Don't worry, I won't try that. But is there anything sensible we can say about this verse? No wisdom can we get hold of, and so on, without waffling on with words about the wordless. I really want to avoid that. And it seems to me that the really crucial phrase in this verse is get hold of. No wisdom can we get hold of. No bodhisattva can we get hold of. No highest perfection can we get hold of. No bodhicitta can we get hold of. The Sanskrit word for get hold of can mean obtain, acquire, gain, as well as understand. It means all those things. I think Konza's get hold of is quite good because it implies both grasping something and understanding something. You know, colloquially, we say, I don't get hold of that, meaning I don't understand it, or I've got it, you know, meaning I understand it. You know, we have words in English, certainly, which can mean both grasp and understand. Apprehend can mean you grasp, you know, apprehend a, you know, something, you get hold of it. But it can also mean understand. Grasp itself, more colloquially, can mean both understand and literally grasp. There's something in language to do with knowing and having, knowing and possessing. And I know Bhante himself has said, when you know something intellectually, you regard it as your possession. You even regard yourself as superior to it. He said that a lot about people's attitudes to the Dharma. You know, a lot of people in the West, their knowledge is intellectual. They think even that they have experience, but it's basically intellectual. And they actually feel superior to it. You see this even within the Sangha itself. You know, I do it, and lots of people do it. You know, we can use all the concepts, and we think we know, we think we've got it. We think it's actually a sort of attainment, but it isn't. What we've got hold of is ideas. The perfection of wisdom literature, in fact, the whole Buddhist tradition actually, is trying to undo all that. You know, the fact is we approach the Dharma out of need. We approach it because we want something. At root, it's because of suffering of one kind or another. We feel kind of inadequate in one way or another. We feel that the Dharma will take that suffering away, that it will be the panacea. It will solve all our problems. It will fix us and life once and for all. Fair enough. You know, that's a completely legitimate motivation. It will work for a while, but there comes a point where that motivation will no longer work. So there needs to be a shift, there needs to be a change. Our whole approach, our whole attitude needs to change. So how and in what way? And here we have to refer much more fully to Bhante's seminar on the Ratnaguna Sanchayagata, given here at Padmaloka in 1976. In particular, we need to refer to a very famous and much misunderstood teaching, which goes by the shorthand, the Greater Mandala. The Greater Mandala. Through this teaching, Bhante attempts to get right inside a bodhisattva. He's really trying to see how a bodhisattva might see the world and what a bodhisattva really does and what the perfection of wisdom actually is. And this has enormous relevance for us. First of all, he picks up on the way in which the Buddhist scholar H.V. Gunter translates the term vidya, which is another term for wisdom, usually translated as knowledge. But Dr. Gunter translates it as aesthetic appreciation. Aesthetic appreciation. He also translates prajna, Dr. Gunter, in one place as analytical appreciative discrimination. And the key thing here is appreciation and aesthetic appreciation. The identification of wisdom with aesthetic appreciation. That's what Bunty is really interested in. So Bunty is saying that what vidya, what wisdom, what the perfection of wisdom really is an aesthetic appreciation of others, of other people, of all things, of all life. And he describes that aesthetic appreciation as in terms of a relishing of people and things. That's a beautiful way of putting it, a relishing of people and things. You see them as they are, in themselves, and you just relish that. You enjoy that. It's a state, he said, this state of aesthetic appreciation, of vidya, of wisdom, of being in harmony with all people and all things. You're deeply in tune with everything. You see everything, everybody, aesthetically, as they are in themselves, with all their life and energy. And when you see everything and everybody aesthetically, you no longer relate to them in terms of what they can do for you, how you can use them, in other words. You no longer see them in terms of utility. Avidya, ignorance, he says, isn't just a state of unknowing. It's a state of alienation and therefore of disharmony with people and things. A state in which you relate to people in terms of their use. There's no empathy in a state of ignorance, no real sympathy. And Bunty gives a very simple example of this, of an experience that he had in Kalimpong when he was a young man. He was walking with a friend, a Nepalese friend, and they came across one of these huge Himalayan trees, I think a great pine tree. And Bunty just exclaimed, "What a beautiful tree! Just such a wonderful sight." And his Nepalese friend, "Yes, this will keep us in firewood for the whole of the winter." So he said, I was probably looking at it not in terms of use. I was just seeing the tree as it is in itself. He said his friend was seeing how it could be used. So we need to make the shift from relating to people and things in terms of use, what they can do for us. We need to move away from that. If we're looking at people and things in terms of what they can do for us, that implies craving and grasping, which implies that we feel that we feel that we possess a fixed and separate self, a real subject in relation to a real other. All that has to go. That is ignorance. That is the opposite of the Bodhisattva path. Instead, we see people and things aesthetically, as they are in themselves, without attempting in any way to use them, to grasp them. We see them with love, we see them with warmth, we see them with metta, as they are, alive and changing, not as things to use. So when we don't see them like that, there is no craving, there is no fixed self that is going to use them. Now, all this sounds very simple. It might sound, what's the big deal in a way? But it's well worth reflecting on. Do we really see others and things as they are in themselves? Or are others and things related to us as, in a way, mere extensions of ourselves? There's so many objects that make us feel safe, comfortable, all right, even our nearest and dearest. Maybe actually they're just really kind of extensions of us for our own use. And maybe we're just extensions of them. What a terrible state of affairs. But I'm afraid that is the way it is for many people a lot of the time. We might even be doing this to the spiritual life itself, to the Dharma. The Dharma is just so many ideas to grasp, so many stages to grab, to possess, to prop us up. And the people in the Sangha, so many people to help us solve our problems, to palliate our loneliness, to help us to get ordained. And if we're all the members, helping others to get ordained, so many people to get ordained in order to help us run our centres. Ordination itself we might see perhaps as promotion, arrival into a handy group, or a ticket to becoming a teacher, where we can, you know, ponce around in front of people. Sorry, I know this sounds all rather drastic, but well worth looking at. Well worth looking at. You know, I'm not saying we're all like that all of the time, and I'm also talking to myself. But it's well worth taking a good, hard look at whether or not we really do practice this aesthetic appreciation, whether we are relating to the perfection of wisdom and the bodhisattva path, or whether we're actually seeing things in utilitarian terms. So how do we shift away from the grasping, utilitarian, ignorant, ego-centered attitude? How do we move away to that, to real aesthetic appreciation, to really relishing others? I love that word, relishing. All others, you know, going beyond, way beyond likes and dislikes. I mean, it's kind of easy to relish people we like, but we're talking about everybody and everything, even people we don't like. We can still relish them. So how do we shift, in other words, from ignorance, avidya, alienation, to the perfection of wisdom, to aesthetic appreciation? Well, Bhante Sangharakshita believes that the shift is made simply by seeing, through seeing everybody and everything as shubha, as beautiful. That's the way a Buddha sees. That's the way a bodhisattva sees. Everybody, everything, all the time are seen as beautiful. They are beautiful. They are shubha, beautiful and pure. Even in the most, apparently ugliest and difficult of situations. Yes, of course, the bodhisattva sees the terrible sufferings all around. The bodhisattva has a deep empathy with all of that, of course. In the Vimalakirti Nidesha, we find the sick Bodhisattva Vimalakirti saying, in answer to Manjushri, Manjushri, my sickness comes from ignorance and the thirst for existence, and it will last as long as do the sicknesses of all living beings. Were all living beings to be free from sickness, I also would not be sick. Why? Manjushri, for the Bodhisattva, the world consists only of living beings, and sickness is inherent in living in the world. Were all living beings free of sickness, the Bodhisattva also would be free of sickness. You ask, Manjushri, whence comes my sickness? The sicknesses of the Bodhisattva arise from great compassion. So this is, Bhante says, commenting on this verse, he says this response of Vimalakirti just rings down the Mahayana tradition. It just kind of rings down the ages, really describing the Bodhisattva's empathy, you know, the Bodhisattva's complete openness to the sicknesses, the dukkha, not just the physical sicknesses, but the spiritual sicknesses of all living beings. The Bodhisattva's not afraid to really take that in, to live that in. This is what we do in the Karuna Bhavana, where we direct our metta at the sicknesses and the dukkha and the suffering of all life. We take it in without horror, without fear, without sentimentality. We completely empathise with every single living being because we are exactly the same as them. But the Bodhisattva sees much more than sickness and suffering, much, much more. Vimalakirti saw much more. The Bodhisattva sees all of life and all beings as beautiful, as flourishing. And this, of course, is what is being communicated by the Buddha's vision at the time of his enlightenment, of all beings as red and white and blue lotuses unfolding in a great lake. What he's seeing is their beauty, their purity, their majesty pushing forth, if you like, Buddhahood itself. Pushing forth. It's a dynamic vision, an unfixed vision. It's a vision of energy, if you like, of living beings as essentially growing beings. And it's said that at that time, the Buddha felt had unshakable great compassion. Actually, the Sanskrit and Pali word for this is anukampa, which literally means to shake with, to shake with. It's a totally positive response to the growing, emerging, flourishing and maturing in life. That's the Buddha's compassion. As much as it is a response to suffering, it's a response to growth. It's a joyous response to the growth in living beings. It's a response to the beauty in all living beings. Because the Bodhisattva sees everybody as beautiful, he has a completely different approach to life and to spiritual life. The Bodhisattva doesn't think in terms of attainment, doesn't think in terms of gaining and grasping, not at all. He thinks in terms of creating, of creating. The Bodhisattva feels no lack. There is nothing but abundance, abundant creativity. That's what the Bodhisattva's life is. Because the Bodhisattva dwells, he always dwells in what Bhante calls the greater mandala of aesthetic appreciation, the greater mandala of beauty, rather than in the lesser mandala of utility, of, if you like, the day-to-day practical activity that we need to engage in. That doesn't mean that the Bodhisattva cannot be practical. He's not a space cadet. He's not sort of spaced out on some sort of trip, alienated from the world. Bodhisattvas are intensely practical. They do engage in the details and practicalities of life, but the practicality is at the service of the vision of beauty, the beauty of living beings, the beauty of the spiritual path, the beauty of the Buddha, the beauty of enlightenment. Because the Bodhisattva is in touch with that vision, the Bodhisattva's activity is described as lila, as play. Yes, he might well be doing things that look really difficult, going into the most difficult of places, fearlessly. But inside, he regards it as play. The Bodhisattva's life in the Vajrayana tradition is called sahaja, which means something like spontaneity. Spontaneity, natural, spontaneous activity. In later Mahayana, it's called anubhogacharya, the path or the coursing in supreme enjoyment. So the Bodhisattva's life is one of just a wonderful display of energy and inspiration, but always facing what is difficult. This playful, blissful energy goes into creating a mandala of spiritual practice. In other words, a spiritual community. And in this seminar, Bhante quotes from a Nyingmapa Lama who defines a mandala, the creation of a mandala is, it means to take any prominent aspect of reality and surround it with beauty. So this is what a bodhisattva does, how a bodhisattva lives. The Buddha, the three jewels, are at the heart and centre of life for a bodhisattva. And what he does is to create a harmonious and beautiful world around the Buddha, around the three jewels, for the benefit of everybody. And he does this naturally. It's not an idea. It's natural because the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha are beautiful to him and are alive for him. I mean, Bhante has never said that he's a bodhisattva. He wouldn't. He wouldn't do that. He's never made any claims. But looking back, looking even now, it's very interesting to reflect on the development of our Sangha, because actually I think that's what Bhante has done. He dwells, or has dwelt, and I imagine he still dwells, in the greater mandala of aesthetic appreciation of beauty. And that was very attractive. That's why he was so attractive to us in the early days. Well, even now, but in the early days, it was just absolutely fascinating to be around Bhante, because you could feel his own response to the beauty of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. You know, we often speak of Sangharakshita as having this wonderfully clear and incisive and encyclopedic mind and so on. But actually, Sangharakshita is a devotee. He's a bhakta, as they say. He's very, very devoted to the Buddha a deep love for the Buddha, a deep love for the three jewels. So you can really feel that. And sometimes as well, I think I can say, you could even sense that his own perception of us, his own sense of our own beauty, of our own spiritual beauty in those days. Sometimes you felt he was seeing much more deeply than we could see ourselves. I've certainly felt that on many occasions, that he was seeing way beyond, you know, my own ideas of myself. I can remember coming back on a train from Brighton with Bhante, the last train at night, a slow train. We'd been down in Brighton, he'd been doing a book launch, and he was sitting opposite me, and on this train, which was taking forever to get back to Victoria. And he didn't particularly want to talk, fair enough. So he handed me one of the books he'd got from a second-hand bookshop, which he used to love going to. So I started to read, but I was tired and I kept dozing off, kept falling asleep. And every so often I'd wake up and I'd just see Bhante just leaning forward, just looking at me with this incredible smile on his face. And I thought, oh, that's weird. And, you know, go back to sleep. And there was this feeling of being seen very, very deeply. And he was just delighting in that, relishing that, seeing something in me that, would bear fruit, I guess. I don't know. But, that and many other things, you know, this sense of being taken absolutely seriously and being delighted in, playfully. And, you know, there's this love, care, attention, energy, inspiration that Bhante had. And out of that, all the activity came. All of the building of centres, the creation of the Sangha. Bhante is just himself, loving the Dharma, communicating the Dharma. It all came out of that. All the activity, all the day-to-day activity. Later on, he talked about this business of creating a mandala he spoke of in terms of building the Buddha land in the Vimalakirti Nidesha series. Traditionally, it's a translation of the way a bodhisattva adorns the Buddha field, adorning, brings up that sense of beauty. So the point I'm trying to make, that all of the different things we have, the ordination process, everything, actually comes out of one man's sense of all-pervading spiritual beauty. That's where all the energy comes from. We need to remember that. We need to tap into that source in our own lives and not get lost. Not get lost in all the details. Not get lost in the little details of utilitarian life. We really have to remember that. So we need to radically transform the way we see things and approach things. And of course, central to all of this, says Bhante, is metta. Metta bhavana. Metta really is the key practice here, as a meditation, as a way of living. Through metta, Bhante says, we learn to see others and all beings, all things, as they are in themselves. We see them with aesthetic appreciation, without grasping, without clinging. You know, try that in your metta bhavana practice. When you do that practice, imaginatively be with the people in the practice. Look at them, sense them, notice them, appreciate them, relish them, see their beauty, even in that enemy, that difficult person. Look for that point of beauty and let the loving kindness, the metta, grow out of that, be a response to that. The Buddha himself in the Pali Canon says that metta bhavana, dwelling in the metta brahma vihara, leads to the liberation called the beautiful. Called Shubha. So it's right there, even in the old Pali texts. And we express this as well in all activities, doing all that we can to bring about the flourishing, the growing, the maturing of everybody. Perhaps if we live like this, we will know what it means to course in the Happy One's wisdom. And actually, I think there's enormous practical significance for order members and for men who've asked for ordination, actually for everybody in the Sangha. How does ordination happen? What's the real meaning of ordination? We don't pass an exam to get ordained. You don't fulfill external criteria to get ordained. You don't even have to complete a certain number of retreats to get ordained. Of course, it's good to go on retreats. Of course, it's good to do all the different practices. But Bhante himself has said that ordination involves, what it really means is a mutual witnessing of one another's going for refuge, of one another's effective going for refuge. The order members, the dharmacharis who know you, what they should be doing if they're going to see you're going for refuge. Well, they've got to see directly that movement in you, that decisive shift, that flourishing, which is going for refuge. It's not just simply having a feeling about it, an idea about it, a vague knowing about it, an idea about it. It should be a direct seeing. They can see that going for refuge because they are deeply in touch with it themselves. It's alive in their own lives. Now, for that to happen, for that seeing to happen, there has to be metta. There has to be metta. There has to be the seeing of the other person as they are in themselves. There has to be aesthetic appreciation on both sides, both from the point of view of the order members and from the point of view of the person who wants to be ordained. There has to be that mutuality of metta. Otherwise, you cannot see going for refuge. It's impossible. There has to be more than that. There has to be Kalyanamitrata, a mutuality of metta. And when that happens, there is a dissolving of boundaries. In spiritual friendship, there's a dissolving of boundaries, of self and other, of subject and object, to some extent. So there has to be aesthetic appreciation. There has to be a non-utilitarian seeing. There has to be vidya. There has to be prajna, to some extent, at least a reflection of vidya, of prajna. There has to be a transcendental element beyond self and other. In other words, there has to be bodhicitta, the aspiration to enlightenment, the urge, the force of wisdom and compassion that actually transcends self and other. Without that, you cannot see going for refuge. It's impossible. Sometimes people can get sort of almost angry and resentful that they're not being ordained. Well, there's no way that you can see it in somebody if they're in that state. It's impossible. There has to be metta. There has to be aesthetic appreciation. And of course, it's the bodhicitta. It's this dwelling in the greater mandala of beauty that really motivates and animates the order. Without it, we're just going to be a religious institution and it's going to be a waste of time. This is the heart of our spiritual life and our community. So let's all let go of all grasping and course in the happy one's wisdom.